Hi, my name is Sharon Barker. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Sharon.
I'd like to thank Tina for introducing me and promptly leaving the stage. Something I did or what? Bill didn't recognize me a couple of minutes ago. He just saw me getting off the plane. I guess he thinks I'm supposed to look gorgeous all the time, but he said I clean up real good. Somebody I didn't even know sitting here said that he came all the way to hear me, so keep it clean. I guess my reputation has preceded me. Bud picked JoJo and I up at the airport, and I thought, here's this nice man. And if he hears parts of our story, he's going to leave us out in the highway somewhere. And thank God you sent one of the alcoholics of our type, because he started telling us parts of his story, and I was fascinated, parts of his story. So I guess you have some sick ones here, too. That's good, because that makes me feel a part of. I didn't come to Alcoholics Anonymous to get good, because if I'm good too long, then I want to put that rose in my teeth and dance on the next table. It is not a moral issue if you're an alcoholic. I was blessed with the gift of sobriety, not wanting it, and I have learned to become comfortable. Comfortable in my sobriety, comfortable within my own skin, and comfortable with my life as it is today. And I am forever grateful to you for that, because I cannot do this on my own. We can do what I can't do, and I have to always remember that. I want to thank you for having me out here. It's been a long time since I've been to Colorado, and I maybe have some amends to make. So if you're out there and I injured you, maybe you're here to make amends to me. I don't know, but... I'm here to tell you a little bit about me, and you will know me better by the end of an hour than my family knows me, than anybody I work with eight and a half hours a day know me. I guess that's because you are my family of understanding, and I have a family of blood, and I might as well start right there, because I am the only alcoholic. If the family was dysfunctional, it was because I was in it. They are all still very normal. They are all still very successful. Nobody has fallen out of the closet drunk or with any sort of other neurotic problems. And no wonder I didn't feel a part of growing up. I grew up in Iowa, and that was my very first resentment from the moment I could realize where I was. And I always thought that I was supposed to be up on the hill somewhere with the horses grazing in the front of the yard and the banker's daughter or another life than where I was. And it wasn't because I didn't have a good childhood. It had nothing to do with the love that was given me or the opportunities or where I was. It had everything to do with me. And alcoholism is an inside thing, boy. Before I ever took my first drink, I had all of the committee in the head that talked to me, and they were always there judging me, the ones that were guilty, the ones that were better than, the ones that just wouldn't shut up. And when I had my first drunk, I was 13 years old, and I remembered something that happened that night. Other than I seemed to grow Marilyn Monroe legs, I seemed to have the chess fairy visit me briefly, I seemed to be able to talk and dance with all the football players, drive their car home, didn't know I knew to drive, tell the jokes, have a great time. But what else happened was everybody up here got drunk. Everybody up in my head got drunk. And we had a good time. And they got quiet, and we just, life happened. You know, from that moment at that Canadian club and that Schlitz beer hit home, you know, it just seemed to ooze out warmth and happiness and contentment and omnipotence. You know, alcohol made me feel powerful when I drank. It gave me a lot of courage. And I gave up myself for alcohol as I drank on and on. When I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, there was not... This person standing here is a product of the 12 steps and the fellowship and service work and a lot of things and a spiritual awakening of Alcoholics Anonymous. This person standing here was not what alcoholism drug in the doors. It was not. And I went off to college because you did that. I hadn't gotten into any big time trouble until then. I was an overachiever, and I kept that was my smokescreen, was that, and I got good grades, and I made the honor roll, and I was in everything, and I was involved, and I got in a little trouble, but in and out, and my smokescreen was I did so much. How could she have a drinking problem? But I drank a lot in high school, and I got drunk a lot, and it affected my attitude. I started to smoke pot because it was the late 60s. I was in college. I was in a Big Ten university. I pledged a sorority. In fact, we drove by one of the houses here driving into town. It was very strange. I got too hip for them, and so I left and started hanging out with the art students, and I started to drop all of my education courses and started taking the fine arts courses because you could stay drunk and you could stay high and you could be creative. And that's what I was doing. I wasn't very prolific, but I would occasionally knock out a canvas after I rolled in the paint on it and did some other kind of strange things. I was into mobiles, plastic mobiles. I would take a lot of LSD and drink my wine and make these mobiles. And, you know, at the time, they were, you know, they would balance, and then I would get them out in the world, and they wouldn't do anything right. And it was just the way my life was. You know, I would seek out truth and find it momentarily. You know, it was, you know, on 16 four-way hits of this Orange Sunshine LSD combined with all the booze I was drinking, I found truth. I mean, you can't not find truth on that, you know, in the course of one evening. But then to find it again the next day, you forget where you put it. You know, I just had a hard time. And I started to get real strange, and I had a suicide attempt out of the blue. I woke up in the morning. I was living in an apartment with some other girls. We had never spent a night alone in that place. It was a crash pad. It was a place where the black radicals came into town and spoke, you know, in the living room with the dashikis. And I'd come home, and these things would be going on. And it was just a strange type of existence. And I got up one morning and took a hit off the hash pipe that was going around and went in the bathroom and sliced my wrist. And my roommate came in and found me, and it was a big scene, and what happened was I wrote my father a letter because I was in pain. I was in some sort of pain. It was a psychic pain. It was, you know, it wasn't that I was in a physical pain, or it was just I was in pain. And I wrote my father, and I told him everything that had been going on in my life. And my father came down abruptly to the school to find me and talk to me and try to help me. And he brought the family priest, and the priest and I got very drunk that night. And I remember introducing him to all the radicals in the student union, and we were talking about peace and brotherhood, and, you know, and my father just shook his head, and you know, I said, if you weren't there for me when I was growing up, you know, and I really started to tell him that things that would hurt him. And I had a place to put my anger now because my dad was there and he was trying to help me, but he was there and I gave him all my anger. And we had huge blowouts, my father and I, and it's what I wanted. I wanted to sever those ties because I felt so bad. See, I have a disease of selective hearing. You know, I was sent to psychiatrists. People were around to try to help me, but what I heard them always say was, "You're not good enough." They would say things like, "Let us help you," or "You have so much potential," or, you know, "If we could just follow this path, maybe you could get to this goal." But what I always heard them say was, "You're not good enough." That's what I heard. And by being honest with myself with the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, because I'm incapable without the program, I have learned to hear the truth. I have learned to hear the truth. And that's another freedom. But my life, from that point on, got more angry. I ended up in a lot of those peace moratorium marches, but what I was doing was I was giving you the peace sign and with one hand and the one finger with the other hand, you know, and I was angry, and I liked to be around violent people, and I was feeling like my life was over. I was beginning to get hopeless. I ended up going to New York City, and I got crazy there, just insane there. I was drinking every night. I did the I Ching every morning and would tell me about my day, and I had a standing appointment with a phrenologist who would read the bumps on my head at the West End Bar every Friday afternoon. And him, you know, he was all wrapped in white, so I could always find him, you know. And he would read the bumps and tell me about my life. And I did tarot cards, and I walked Central Park, and I brought people home who played musical instruments I had never met before in my life, and we would jam all night long. And then I would take some more uppers and drink some more alcohol, and off to work I would go and work to this advertising agency. And I did this over and over and over again. And I didn't sleep much, and I didn't eat much, and I just got just crazy. And I couldn't go underground, and I had anxiety attacks all the time. And I begged my father, let me go back to school, and he gave me one more chance. He gave me another chance. I had a lot of opportunities to do a lot of things with my life. And it was over for me. I couldn't study anymore, I couldn't focus anymore, and I didn't care anymore. And I'm 20 years old. It's over. And I got a chance to go to Colorado to be a cowboy. So I got on a train, and I took the Amtrak. I ended up in Carbondale, Colorado, closest to Aspen I could get. And I lived with a woman, a winette named Faith. And she had a charge at the liquor store. It was great. There was a bar called the Mountain Man Bar that had shuffleboard, and I would pass out with the sawdust all over me. And I got a job at a little restaurant, and the people were being nice to me. I wasn't too obnoxious yet. And I thought I met Bob Dylan, or I don't know who he was, but he walked into that restaurant, you know, and looked like him, yeah, walked like him. And that was the summer he was missing, you know. And I thought, God, it's him. And this man ordered a chocolate milkshake to go, and I promptly made two chocolate milkshakes to go, and I got in the car with him, and we came to California. And I'm not sure quite who he was. He was very spiritual, I can tell you that. In Laguna Beach, he went his way, and I went mine. And I ended up at a commune in Huntington Beach, California. I came with $2. I left with $4 and a dog. I stayed for months. I made a profit. I mean, it was like life was beginning to turn around for me. I turned 21 out here in California. I turned 21 in Westwood, and the Krishnas were there that night. And I was panhandling outside the liquor store for my wine, and that's what I was doing. And I got my bottles of wine, and I was going to go have my birthday. And what happened was the Krishna spotted me. And I don't know about you, but I think I had this brown aura. You know, this hole in my psyche. And it was like, I remember the Pentecostal Holy Rollers in Colorado got a hold of me. And, you know, and what they said made sense because I was so empty inside. And it was like people could spot that, you know. But as soon as they got me to the water and they started talking about eternity, you know, I bolted. I was with the Jesus Freaks in Laguna. I thought they were nice people, and they played neat guitar, and they were a family. And I liked that camaraderie, and they seemed to kind of follow that peace and love stuff. And you know, but as soon as they talked about forever, I was running down the beach, you know. And these Krishnas, we were having a good time. I was drunk. I knew the words, you know. They're not too hard, you know, Hari Hari, Rama Rama, all that kind of stuff. And I was dancing right along with them, and they thought it was very karmic that I was 21 that evening and I had become theirs. And we were going off into nirvana, I guess, and as soon as they said that word forever, I was gone. Because, see, if I couldn't put it in my backpack right now, this instant, I didn't want to own it. I lived a day at a time before I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. It's one of the reasons I never walked down that long path to the altar, too, because it was till death do you part, you know, and I knew I couldn't do that. I couldn't do that. So I ran away from them, and I ended up, Faith had rented out my room for me, my loft. I had this crooked loft that I slept on above a fireplace. It got very hot all the time, but I thought I was having flashbacks or something. But she had rented this out, and I remember there was like a box of my things, and there was a whole bunch of my stuff there. There were things on the wall. There were my quilts over the couch. There were my pans in the kitchen. And I said, excuse me, I used to live here. Let me just pick up this box of things. And I, as I walked out of there, I thought, go get the rest of your things. What's wrong with you? You those are yours. And I didn't even have enough self-worth to walk back into that place and go, these are mine. I'm going to take them and leave. I had ended up with my mother and father. I'm 21 years old. I'm dying of alcoholism. I had a I went to the family doctor because I wasn't feeling well. He gave me Valium for my nerves. See, my mother and father said I could stay there as long as I didn't take drugs, but it was okay for me to drink. My father and I did not speak. We passed in the hallway, and that was it. Nobody opened up the conversation. I had a non-functional gallbladder and pancreatitis, and I was dying, and nobody knew it. Nobody knew it. Nobody knew alcoholism. They said, Sharon just wouldn't take those drugs. And I was drinking every night in those taverns, looking at the losers every night, judging them in there every night. I'm in there every night judging the losers, my ex-friend from high school. I met him, and he was going to take care of me, and it was the first man in a long time that was, I guess, semi-okay. He was organic, so he wasn't too neurotic or violent, and he took me to northern Wisconsin to an organic farm, and this was going to be my new answer. And little did I know, that's a lot of work. We heated with wood, we cooked with wood, we ground our own wheat. You know, I made the bread. He took away my cigarettes and he took away my alcohol, and he gave me these packs of pot he would roll up for me. These packs of joints. It was organic pot, so it was okay. And that's what he gave me. And we made maple syrup that year. We worked hard. And, I'm smoking this stuff from morning to night incessantly. And I woke up and I lit a joint, and that was it. I mean, from morning till night. And it was the second snowfall of the winter. I made a very important decision in my life. And it was one of those nights where the snow's beginning to look heavy. And I know you all know how that feels. You know you're going to be stuck for about 2 days. And we were way back in the woods, and it took 2 or 3 days the first time it snowed hard for the snowplow to get to us. And this was looking that way that night. And Phil was playing the banjo in the corner. And, we didn't have a TV. I was sitting there reading Mother Earth News or Yul Gibbons or something, organic. And he was playing that banjo, and he had this record, how to play the banjo with Pete Seeger. And I don't know if you know about Pete Seeger, but he's got this lilting little kind of childlike voice, and he was telling Phil how to go bum titty with that five string. You got to go bum with one and titty with the fingers, and he was picking it up and starting it over because he'd miss a key and he'd miss a note and it sounds sour, and he'd pick it up and here we hear Pete Seeger start all over again, and I'm rocking faster in this chair, I'm really going for it. And the cat's flicking its tail, it's really going, and the dog is looking at me like, God, do something, And I'm just really feeling it. And I got up out of that chair, and I got in the station wagon with the big sun painted on the hood, and I bolted into this one-horse town that had 2 cheap gallons of wine, and I bought them. And I got home, and I put the wine on the table. He took a look at the wine, looked at me, and he went to bed because he had seen me, how I act. A couple glasses later, the cat's smiling, the dog's dancing with me. We're all feeling better. Such relief. And we had a party that night, me, the cat, and the dog. And it was about 2 a.m. that he woke up, and he stood at that bedroom door, and he gave me that look that I had seen my father give me, a look of, what are you doing to yourself? That look that my mother had given me of that hurt, and why do you have to act like this? And that look. And my head said, as loud as I can hear my own voice tonight, clearly I heard it. It said, alcohol is more fun than you, Phil. And I made a decision that night that I wasn't going to get thirsty again. And you know what? I didn't. I slowly pushed him away. He was an Al-Anon without a program. He hung in there with me for a long time. And finally, I drove him away, and it was spring. He hung in there that long. And all the organic community boycotted me, and they blackballed me one night at one of their meetings for being a drunk. And I didn't care. I didn't want their primal therapy and their other ways of doing things. I went out and screamed at the sheep and got drunk, the 50 head of organic sheep. And that was fine with me. And my life became my life again with how I'm going to handle it. We had a half acre of marijuana he had planted back in the woods, and he left me with that, and I thought that was class. And so that's what I did that summer, is I weeded that pot, and I lived out there, and I took my bottle out there, and me and the dog and the cat and the horse, we would spend all day out there weeding it and eating it and, reading poetry and all of that stuff. And I just got, I was comfortable. And my friend Clarence the farmer would bring the booze nightly, and he was my party with Clarence and me. And Clarence, I would hear his tractor coming up the lane, and I'd feel instantly better because I know that more booze was on the way. And Clarence drove the tractor because he had too many DWIs, and they took away his license, so he was on the tractor. And then his wife took away the keys to the tractor, and that was it. I was alone. And I harvested this pot because winter was coming. I wasn't going to be cold again, and I was alone. And it took me 3 days by horseback, obsessively doing this. And I got it all, and it was all ready to go, and the deal was all cut, and these people, I was going to meet these people and turn this deal and get out of town. I didn't know where I was going, but I was getting out of town. And I drove into this town, 45 miles into town, and I stood at their door and knocked at their door, and they let me in, and they said, "Where's the stuff?" And I looked at my dog, and my dog looked at me, and we forgot it. We left it back on the farm. So I did the next best thing, which was join the carnival. It was in town. And they had a job available. I guess I passed their requirements. I packed up my pot and some clothing and my dog, and off we went. And I ran the shooting gallery for a while. And I called my mother and told her where I was. I think it was in Arkansas when I called her. And she started to cry, and she didn't believe I had done this. And now I can't call home and talk to my mother because she's upset with me. I can't talk to my father. It's been years since I've talked to my father. And I started to just not call home after that unless I absolutely had to. I fit right in. I mean, my cowboy boots were back on. Now I had the pot. They had the uppers. We had an instant friendship. They drank while they were on duty. They drank all night long. You could come in and blow into town for 2 or 3 days and leave your mess behind you and just leave town. And that's what I was really happy living that vagabond type of life. I didn't know I was taking me with me. I didn't know that for a long time. Somewhere down south, though, I caused a little bit too much of a scene one evening on the Midway, and the next day I found a couple shotguns in my stomach as I answered the door to the motel room. And they came in. It was some of Louisiana's finest. And I ended up getting thrown in maximum security in Bogalusa, Louisiana for drugs because I, of course, had my own personal stash and everything else. And they threw me in jail, and they handed me my rights next day through the bars, and they wouldn't let me out, and I couldn't make a phone call. And I was crazed for a week. I just had no idea that this was going to happen. I drank Pruno. I made friends with the murderer that was next door to me. You know, awful stuff, but if you hold your nose, it'll get you off. And finally, I got to call my brother-in-law, and he was an attorney in New York, and he called my father, and my father flew down. Bless you. And my dad, and I met him at the attorney's office that he had hired, and I'm in handcuffs. And he's sitting next to me a foot away. We're in a nice office in those nice chairs, and I couldn't even look at him, and he couldn't even look at me. And I tell you, if I could have just crawled under the rug that day, I would have, the way I felt. He couldn't do anything. He just hired this attorney, which couldn't do anything. And I was there for 31 days before they cut me loose. And when they cut me loose, they said, "Don't leave the state, and we're going to go to court." And so I didn't. I found my way across Lake Pontchartrain, and I found the French Quarter of New Orleans. And if you're an alcoholic, you will fall in love with the French Quarter of New Orleans. Every other doorway is a bar. I started to dance on Bourbon Street. I don't know. I guess I thought I had a flair for it. But if you have too much cognac and you have this little baby grand piano you're supposed to do this little slinky number on, and you come out and you do your little pose and you wait for the music to start, and they had this palm tree on the wall. It had these staples in it, and I had to wear these fishnet stockings. And the fishnets would always get stuck on this palm tree, you know. And I had this number that I tried to slink around for the whole song, you know, and do this thing. And then one night I just ripped them off. I said, "The heck with it." And, you know, I'm the kind of alcoholic by this time that I don't digest alcohol quickly at all. I don't eat food, but I bloat up. And I remember just my fat just kind of pouring through this hole in these fishnets. And, you know, there was I think the Alabama football team was there that night. And they just, you know, I felt about that big. There was not much left to me as a human being of some worth that night. And I had another drink, of course, as soon as I got down off that piano, because it was still working for me. And I had a relationship of 2 years, a guy I met in the carnival. That's where he is, girls, if you want to meet somebody with a lot of potential. That's where they are. And he and I moved in together, and he worked tugboats, and he would be out for 4 or 5 days and in for 4 or 5 days. And he didn't understand my new friends he'd always find me with. And, you know, it's like, this is a one-armed sea captain. Come meet Gil. He's a great guy. You should see him dance and sing to have and have not. And boom, he'd give me a black eye. And, you know, and then he'd go shoot some heroin, come home, and then boom, I'd give him a black eye. And we had a sick relationship for 2 years. And my parents came to visit me in the middle of this. They were in Texas, and they drove over to find their daughter because they hadn't heard from me in a while. And they found me, and I was living above a biker bar, and it was a seedy place, and it was a very dirty, filthy, dark, dingy tar paper roof apartment. And we had a pet skunk that was, it stunk, the whole place smelled. We had a pet snake because Kirby put the snake in my dad's face upon meeting him. You know, the dog, and I didn't look too good, and Kirby didn't look too good, and we probably had 2 new black eyes, and my father's jaw flinched a lot, I remember, and my mother couldn't look at me, and she had tears in her eyes. And when they went home that day, I knew that if I went with them, you know, as they went down the street, I wanted to say, God, let me come with you. I'm so tired of this. But I knew instinctively nothing would change. I didn't know I was suffering from the disease of alcoholism, and neither did they. I just felt bad, so bad. And this guy's parole got pulled, and I should have been happy, but I followed him to St. Louis. I went to find him, and because it wasn't my idea, it was over yet. And so I got drunk one night, packed everything up, and moved to St. Louis. And after living in that town for a couple of months, I found him. And he got off his Harley, and he walked over to the side of the car that I had, and he cracked the window and pulled my head through. And he spit in my face, and he said, if I ever see you again, I will kill you. And that's when I knew the relationship was over. That's the way I give up. That's it. And I want to share with you in sobriety, I said yes to an AA commitment I didn't want to say yes to one day, which was to drive from Los Angeles to Bakersfield, which is about a 2.5-hour trip, to read a vision for you at a Sunday morning meeting. Not to speak, just to read a vision for you at a closing meeting of a conference. And I said yes because I say yes if the time is available. And I was probably about 3 years sober at the time. And coming back, I was sleeping in the car, and I was with my then husband, my first and only husband, my one only ex-husband. Keep that straight, I'm from California, you know. But I was sleeping in the car, and I woke up, and right next to us, I looked out the window, and there was Kirby on a motorcycle next to me on the freeway somewhere in the valley. And I woke up just at that instant to see this was a little God incident happening in my life. And I said to Al, I said, my God, there's Kirby. You know, he knows parts of my story. He said, you want me to hit him? What do you want me to do? And I said, don't worry, I'm not going to wave. Just stay next to him for a while. And it was him. And he was on a Honda. And he wasn't flying colors. He had a light blue sweatshirt and a little roll around him. And he had a watch. And I got to see he was okay. And I've had things like that come full circle for me in sobriety. It's just being in the right place where God wants me to be at the right time by suiting up and showing up. But after I left St. Louis, I came back to New Orleans. I got lesser and lesser jobs tending bar. I was a bartender. And the Jose Cuervo Gold I was drinking didn't seem to quite do it for me. It didn't seem to quite shut the head off. It didn't seem to quite make me feel like somebody tonight and give me that instant courage and let me go, you know, to Mississippi and start all over or whatever I wanted to do. It wasn't happening anymore. I was starting to get real tired. And I would look in that back bar mirror and I would see a fat, derelict-looking alcoholic woman. I would see a loser. And it wasn't working for me all the time anymore. And my last job on Lower Decatur Street was dancing with the guys off the boats, the guys that work with the oil underneath, because they always smelled like engine. It wasn't one of your upper-class, upper-crust bars. It was Lower Decatur Street. You walked down the street, you could smell it. And I got asked to leave that job for having a bad attitude. And when I came back to town after a little respite, I begged for that job back, and they didn't want me back. They did not want me on their premises. Mardi Gras 1975, I was with my friend Michael, who was a bouncer at Pat O'Brien's, and we were partying, and that's all you do, you know, and what else is new? And I was in and out of a brownout, and we were on my way to my house to have some sort of a party, another party, continue it, and it was... Michael had a gun in him. I remember him pointing at these people on the street and because he didn't like their costume or something. I said, oh, put your gun away. It's Mardi Gras. But there was no reality going on with me. You know, this guy has a gun. And I just brought him to my house. We got some more wine. He started shooting at people off the balcony. The police were called. I was the last person to speak to him in his lifetime. I guess I asked him to leave because he was starting to cause a little bit of trouble with the people there. And I asked him to leave, and I was the last person to speak to him. I don't remember what I said to him, because I closed the door on him, and the next thing I remember that there were shots that rang out, and he was killed by two policemen because he leveled the gun at them. And the one that he leveled the gun at knew him. Now, when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, Norm Alpey used to talk about seconds and inches. Seconds and inches that we get to sit in this seat today, judge each other, judge the speaker, judge the coffee, whatever you want to think. You know, it's a gift that we have sobriety, because people that need to be here didn't make it here. People that need to be here today, want to be here today, aren't here today. And we are lucky to have the gift to be sitting in this seat. And I knew what Norm meant when he talked about that, seconds and inches. And that was one of those days. I ended up going to New York and dying at my sister's house. I just holed up. I drank Jack Daniels. And I just holed up in a room. I couldn't even go out into the world. I was too paranoid. I ended up coming to California, and I was with some people writing a book on American Indian arts and crafts that were more alcoholic than me, I thought, but they were teaching me how to drink because I was going into blackouts too quickly. And they would leave me in the middle of the street in Maryland because I was so obnoxious, and then they'd feel bad and come back and get me. And I've since met one in the program. We ended up in Barney's Beanery in Southern California, which was a bar of a lot of sick alcoholic people. It was my type of bar, and I remember being there on a Saturday night, and there was an empty seat on either side of me because Mama Cher was in town. You didn't know if she was going to punch you out with the next drink she took or throw up on your clothes, you know. And it was a crowded night, but nobody wanted to sit next to me. I was that obnoxious. But I was frantic for the alcohol to work. It just wasn't working. I got hired for 10 minutes as a cocktail waitress, and they asked me to please leave because I couldn't remember where I was going with anything. I was 170-plus pounds of bloated alcoholic mess, and I didn't bathe anymore. And I ended up getting on the back of a motorcycle one night, and I thought I was being asked to go somewhere. And I found out when I got in the back of the bike was that it was windy going through the desert that night, and they needed a little extra weight. So they called the fat one out to sit on the back of the bike. And that's the way I got asked to go to places. I had become the lower companion. We ended up in Palm Springs, and they left me, of course, and I found two new lower companions. I was real good at finding the victimizer. I don't know about you, but I could walk into a room of this size, and the sickest one would always find me. I don't know how I did it. It was just like the victim will always find the victimizer. And that night I did, in a crowded nightclub. I found two of them, and I guess they took me somewhere, and I guess they raped me, and they beat me up badly, and they broke my jaw in three places, and they kicked me in the face a lot, and they pushed my nose off. And I came to in and out of this concussion and blackout and everything that was going on in my life that night, and I realized that this was really happening to me. It wasn't a sleeping DT, or it wasn't a situation I can talk my way out of, that I didn't care anymore. I stopped screaming. I just stopped screaming, and they took me outside of town. It was about 6 in the morning, and they rolled me off of the side of the road down into the sand where you couldn't see me if you drove by. They had left me there to bleed to death with no clothes on, and I heard something got my attention that morning. I was beaten so badly by my disease that I finally heard the truth, and the truth was, get up, I want to live. I heard that voice, and it came from inside of me somewhere. And I did. I got up, and I went up the side of this road, and I ended up at somebody's condominium where a gardener found me. And the gardener called the police, and I had become, on their docket, what I had been wanting to become for a long time, victim, Sharon Meyer, right there in print. Right there, what I wanted to be. It was right there for me, you know. Call the yearbook, call the family, tell them I made it, you know. But something happened to me that morning again, you know, stripped away from just being ready to hear the truth that morning. Going into surgery, I heard some words, and the words said, you know, these guys didn't do this to you. Your father didn't put you on this gurney. It's not that Catholic Church and all the guilt you heard about. It's not your concept of anything that put you, you know. It's you that put you here on this gurney. You did this to you. And I heard that. I don't know why I heard that, but I heard that. I laid in the hospital for 2 weeks, and some other fortuitous events happened in my life I had absolutely no control of. I was being led to you. Because what happened was nobody sent me an airline ticket. Nobody called up and said, let's go start over in Arizona, Sharon. I've heard you've had a hard time. They let me lie there. And it was a blessing. Because I ended up living with a guy on above a liquor store in West Los Angeles after I got out 2 weeks later. They had caught these guys. I had to go back for court. I had to go back to doctors. I couldn't leave town for a while. I had to drive back and forth between L.A. and Palm Springs. And you know what else? I was tired. I was so tired that I just didn't have it anymore. And I was on a liquid diet because I had all these wires all over my face. And this guy was buying me red wine to drink because it was the cheapest I think he could get. And we lived above the liquor store, so he would just go down and get me the red wine for the day, and he would go off to work, and I would sit there and suck on this red wine through the wires and where the tooth had been. I could suck on this red wine. And you know what? There was no more warmth in alcohol. There was no more magic in it. There was no more life in alcohol for me. It was gone. I didn't even like the taste. And something had happened to me. And it was August 20th, 1975, he said to me, you know what, you got to leave, you're just too depressing. And I had nowhere to go. Nowhere to go. So I called my mother in Iowa, Colette, of course, and she said to me the words that changed my life, because my mother didn't know for 2 days when I was in the hospital how bad I was, if I was living or dying. She had gotten a panic phone call from somebody in a hospital in California, and it took my sister in New York 2 days to find me. So for 2 days, my mother was on her knees letting me go. And when I called my mother on August 20th, she said to me, Sharon, I can't help you anymore. Why don't you go to the Salvation Army? Now, if my mother was sent $20, seconds and inches, you'd have another speaker. I would not be here because she said she couldn't help me anymore. And I called the next phone number that was sitting there, a woman I had met in that bar, Barney's Beanery, not relating that she had been a part-time member of Alcoholics Anonymous. First time I met her, she had a big book under her arm, and she was so drunk to drive, they called her a taxi to go to A&A, you know. All I knew. So Chris said to me, words that changed my life, she said, you know what, I can't help you, but this woman can. And she goaded me into calling this woman named Suzanne that I had never met before, but she told me she wasn't going to give me the number unless I didn't call, and she knew how to play me. So I said I would promise that I would call Suzanne, and you know what? I had nowhere to go. I was just doing the next thing, and Suzanne was a member of Alcoholics Anonymous in good standing for 5 years. I was brought to you. I didn't come seeking you out. I didn't even want to cut down when I got here. I had no idea that the archway to good living in Alcoholics Anonymous was getting sober, because I couldn't imagine my life without alcohol. Even though it wasn't working for me, I could not imagine life without alcohol. I had built everything up and given up pieces of myself on the bar. Just let it work tonight. Parts of my soul, everything for alcohol. I couldn't imagine a life without it. And I ended up at a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous that night. These two girls came and picked me up, and they had bright, cheery smiles, and I hated them, and they were clean and pretty, and I thought, what do they want with me? You know, I had broken shoes, my jeans were ripped, I had a bleach-stained T-shirt on, I had wires all over my face, I was black and blue, I hadn't combed or washed my hair. They couldn't even wash it in the hospital because they had to get, they just tried to comb it in the hospital. It was long and scraggly. And they were happy to have me. I didn't get it. You know, they put me in the front row of this meeting. You know, I didn't know how people knew I was new. I had no idea. You know, no idea. other than you could smell me. I know that. I passed the 20 questions with 17 and made this man that looked like my grandfather happy. I had to lie about a few. And I didn't know what was going on. I didn't hear anything the speaker said. And then they got this big blue book up and they started beating on that. And I thought, oh my God, where's the forever test? You know, where do we sign our worldly possessions away forever? Where do we change our name? When do I take the test? When do I have the lecture of what I've done with my life? When does it happen? And I sat there and waited for the other shoe to drop, and it didn't drop. They just laughed at me and just said, keep coming back, kid. Don't drink and use between meetings, and we'll pick you up tomorrow night. And that was the only instruction I heard. Don't drink and use between meetings, and we will pick you up tomorrow night. Well, I heard that. So when I went back to this liquor store, I pulled the covers and I detoxed. That's the way I detoxed, was just by pulling the covers. And they picked me up tomorrow night, and then they found out I had to leave this liquor store, and they were happy to move me out. And they moved me onto some newcomer's floor for a week, and they gave me a sleeping bag, and they gave me a big book, and I gave them my last quarter because nobody's going to give me anything. What do you want for this? You know, and the first 3 months I was here, I was wired up, and I couldn't talk, and I had to learn to listen. It was a beautiful blessing in disguise. Couldn't say a word, not one word. And I sit in my chair and listen. And I didn't drink and use between meetings. And all of a sudden, I realized I hadn't put my hand up for under 30 days. That I had third. There is no way I could even have 2 days of sobriety. I didn't want to stop drinking. And I realized I didn't put my hand up for being under 30 days anymore. And things were starting to happen for me that I couldn't do for myself. I got moved around a lot with this roving sleeping bag and my paper bag of mismatched goods, and I slept on all these women's floors, and then they reject me after a week. I didn't know it was like a week commitment. I never even got that together, and I would feel rejected, and they would stick me in the kitchen to wash cups at this one meeting, and this guy with a Texas accent and a tattooed tear kept telling me to get a sponsor. I'd get drunk, and he'd get right in my face, and I didn't like his little Texas accent at all, and I didn't like his tattooed tear, and I didn't like him touching me, so I got a sponsor, and I learned something beautiful. That night, I learned, first of all, your life gets better when you get a sponsor, because she moved me from the floor to her couch right away. I mean, my life got better as soon as I got a sponsor, and that attached to something somewhere. And I also learned motives don't count. You know, looking back on that, motives don't count. I have done so many things with my life since I have been in Alcoholics Anonymous that I haven't wanted to do. But I've done them because I told somebody I would do them, because I am responsible, because I keep my commitments, all of that stuff. I haven't wanted to do half the stuff that I've done in Alcoholics Anonymous, but as soon as I suit up and show up and life starts happening, I feel better. And my life has gotten better because of that, because I say what I'm going to do. I do what I'm going to say. And whether I feel like it or not, I mean, my God, I don't even feel like putting my feet on the floor a lot of mornings. You know, the committee's loud and they're talking to me before I even get my feet on the floor. But I hit the floor running. You know, I've just got to do that. And I got a job at 3 months of sobriety because the wires came off and they made me go become self-supporting through my own contributions. And they wouldn't let me become a bartender, so I had to go be a food waitress. And they didn't understand that I didn't like this. And my tips were rotten. And my, you know, and they asked me one night how it was going. I said, bad. And they said, well, you know, why? And I said, well, I don't know. And so, you know, what was happening was people were saying, how are you? And I'd tell them, you know, and nobody wanted to sit in my station. I mean, after having breakfast with me once, I'll tell you. And I had a bad attitude, and I didn't take good care of you, and so my tips were bad. And so they taught me how to fake it till you feel it, because I thought you had to be honest in all your affairs. I mean, that's what, so I'm out there in interviews giving them parts of my story. I mean, that's why it took me so long to even get a waitress job. And they said, no, Sharon, in here you're honest in all your affairs. Out there, they just want you to work. They pay you for work, not parts of your story or to think. They just want you to work. So I learned how to fake it until I felt it, you know, and I would go out there and give them an Al-Anon smile. They taught me how to do that. And so I would go out there, and nobody knew I was acting. They had no idea I was acting, none at all. And my tips got better. That was the beauty, is my life changed. You know, and I learned something very valuable about being a good employee, is you just show up and you do what they ask you to do. And I didn't know how to do that. You know, if you wouldn't let me go out of town for 2 weeks, I quit. I mean, that's the way I handled my jobs before. And I became a good employee. And I got a better waitress job. A couple years of sobriety, I got a job with a travel agency, and I had to go to Mexico. I had to fly to Mexico all the time. And I found out that I hated to fly sober, and I was just crazed. I had no idea that that I hadn't flown sober. So I would try to do this chanting of having faith over fear all the way down there, and I'd have all these travel agents with me who are drinking, and, you know, I got my big book in the briefcase, and I'm hanging, I'm white-knuckling, and I'm just crazed. And somebody told me God either is or he isn't. You know, that's in the big book. And, you know, I'd never seen it before. And she said, she added, if he isn't, we're all dead anyway. You know, so I started to let God get on the plane with me. I did things like I wouldn't fly in anything but cotton because cotton wouldn't stick to you when you burned. You know, I mean, that's how crazy my mind was. No polyester. It'll just slam on your skin, you know. I got a 12-step call walking out the door one time to go on this business trip to Acapulco. I said, that's it. We're going down. I can't take this 12-step call. I was always looking for a sign, you know, a negative sign. And the beautiful thing is when I was going to Montreal to the international convention, I had my baby with me. I was more concerned about how he would fly than how I would fly. And I got better. I got better by caring about somebody else like I do in Alcoholics Anonymous. By worrying about you and getting out of my little plans, my self-centeredness, I get better. And I applied that to this peer and it began to work for me. And I'm really okay today. I just yank on the headset and crank up the volume and get on my book. And I know how many people are between me and each exit and how much everybody weighs, so which exit to go for. And my feet are always flat in the ground listening to that vibration. But we're a lot better today, I'll tell you. I got emotionally involved when I was about 3 months sober. They said don't, and that was an attraction. And he had 6 months more time than me. He had 27 and a half tattoos. The half intrigued me. He had done his inventory because I read it. I mean, I knew all about him. He brought me flowers. He wrote me poetry. He wooed me. Do you know how long it had been? It was wonderful. We began to have an AA relationship of he does the coffee, I do the cookies, you know. We're in general service together. We're at every meeting together. We go on 12-step calls together. We had the same, my sponsor was married to his sponsor. I remember one night he was on the phone with his sponsor and I said, okay, pass the phone to Janet. And Janet got on the phone and she said, if you want to talk to me, you call me yourself. And she slammed the phone down in my ear. I thought, what is she doing? What is going on? And it's getting too hot in here? I don't feel a thing yet. But she made me realize that we have to have separate programs. And she started to do the hip therapy, you know, kind of saw us apart. And I was 11 months sober, and I hadn't done my fourth step. We did the third step together because, you know, we did it on our knees. She hugged me. I thought I was gay momentarily. I didn't know what was up and what was going on. The second step, I realized that I was beginning to get a little sane because I didn't want to go back to New Orleans to get my clothes. I mean, clothes that you wouldn't even put on your best drag queen friend. I mean, it was like, leave them there, you know. The first step I felt I had done because I raised my hand for 30 days and I admitted my life was unmanageable, or I would at least come in here with matching luggage and that paper bag. So that was as far as I had gotten. I mean, that was about it. And she had me working on my fourth step and I didn't really know what I was doing. And I'll tell you one thing, I didn't want to share anything with her or anybody else. Who are they, you know? Why am I going to pour my heart out to somebody who's just going to judge me? And I had a lot of fear is what happened. And I was 11 months sober and I got a credit card in the mail, and it was God's will, I guess, and I ended up at the airport that day, and I called up Janet, and I said, well, I'm going to go have my slip now, because I've been listening to everybody talk about having their slip, and I'm so glad they had their slip, because they learned this, and they learned that, and if they wouldn't have had their slip, I mean, I had tunnel vision with my hearing for a while, and so I called her, and I said, Janet, I'm going to go have my slip, I don't know where I'm going, but I'll be back, don't worry about me, and I hadn't called her in a couple of days, but she was already a little ticked off with me, So that's fine, Sharon. Don't finish your inventory and go have your slip. Go ahead. Go off like my friend Stella. She was a long, raven-haired beauty, went off and had her slip, and she burned up in a bed. She She wouldn't finish her inventory either. Well, you know, I dropped the phone because all I could think about was me burned up in a bed and how I'd look, you know. And I have this thing about being burned up, I guess. I don't know. But they go to sponsor school for these stories, and they wait, you know, they wait until you're really down, and then they jam it to you. And, well, she did. She ticked me off again, you know. She ticked me off. And what happened was I ended up at one of those coffee shops with a notebook I had just bought, and I was writing because I was so mad at her. And what happened was the anger overcame the fear. I mean, it got me past the point that I was just writing this stuff out, you know. And I had finished most of it by the time I left the airport that night. And I don't know about you, but I go to the airport to write every inventory still to this day. It just works for me. I don't know if it's the jet fuel, whatever it is, it just works for me. And I took my fifth step with her. It was the week before my first birthday. And she shared parts of her story back with me that I didn't know about her. And she didn't laugh at me. She didn't throw me away. And she loved me. And when I took my first birthday cake, I felt like I deserved it. I stood up straight and tall because I had been sober a year, but I had done something that was very hard, which was do that fourth and fifth step. I hadn't done anything that hard since maybe learning to ride a bike, and I felt good about me. It was really a wonderful feeling. I felt more committed to Alcoholics Anonymous, that I had earned my seat here. And 2 years of sobriety, I got married. I hadn't worked on any character defects up until this time because I didn't have any, you know. I was still numb is what was wrong. First time I remember seeing anger in my life was when I hit my husband over the head with a flashlight because he had a headset on. He was drawing and paying no attention to me. And I hit him with a flashlight one night, and I picked up the flashlight off his head, and that's when I realized this was anger. I mean, that's how unconnected I was with myself. There were a lot of short circuits within me. I mean, when I was a newcomer, you'd ask me how I was, you better wait for at least 45 seconds because the Rolodex has to spin. You know, and you better be a patient, kind old-timer and wait. And it would land on a card, you know. And I always said the thing that it always landed on, which was fine. When they asked me how I was, it was always fine. And that's how rummy I was when I started with you. I was just not connected. It was amazing that I was able to drive a car and function in the world. My dad and my sisters and my mother came out for the wedding. It was an Alcoholics Anonymous wedding. It was two ex-Catholics being married by a Baptist minister with a day at a time putting the vows before death do you part. And we had a rock and roll band, and my dad and I wanted to do a dance together. And, you know, the only kind of two-step dance they knew how to do was Mack the Knife. So that was my wedding song, was Mack the Knife. And we had a great time. We had a wonderful time. And my father looked at me at the end of the day, and he said, look at your life, Sharon, and look at these people you've got it made. And my dad was finally giving me some approval, but the neat thing was I already had some of my own. You know, the earth didn't tremble when he finally said, you're okay, kid. I already knew I was okay, kid, because the 12 steps and you people had given me that by forcing me to grow when I didn't want to, by telling me I can when I knew I can't. And I started to finally work on some defects. I started to get honest about some of my amends. I had to work a little bit more on my relationship with my God because I wasn't praying. That sponsor Janet said to me one night outside of our Thursday night meeting, she said, you know, Sharon, you better get a God or you are going to get drunk. You know, because I'm beginning to get a little cocky and get my rights back. So Beacon's moving van drove by that night, right there by us. And so I said, fine, Janet, my new higher power is Beacon's moving van. And I just wanted to kick her off. And she looked at me and said, fine, as long as it's not you. And but it made sense to me and all the other newcomers, you know. It's like I kind of went from place to place in the country, but I made it one piece. And it was like God put me in the back of a Beacon's moving van and wrapped me in quilts and sent me off my way, and I made it to you in one piece, a little scarred up and a little knob off the dresser here, a little scratch here, but we made it. And so it made good sense to me, and I could pray to Beacon's moving van. It worked for me. And I'll tell you, it was a year ago I was in Texas, and I was not going to make my flight, and I was frothing at the mouth and just feeling all this anxiety, and I was so uptight, and I had to be a good example and not scream at the person driving to drive faster in the traffic that we couldn't move in. And right by us went Deacon's moving van. You know, and I just, I relaxed. Everything just got okay for a minute, you know? And I had been lost out there. I went with one of my babies. We were speaking one night, and we had no gas, and we were in a bad part of Los Angeles, and we were on some freeway we didn't even know existed, and both of us have lived there a long time. And it was a Monday night, and it was dark, and it was late, and there were no lights and no gas station, and we drove right up to where they all go to sleep. All these moving vans go to sleep. You know, there was a whole yard full of Beacon's moving vans. Both of us felt instantly better. My son points them out to me when he sees, and I just tell him it reminds me of God, so he always points them out to me. Look, Mom, there's God, you know? My concept has broadened because of you and because of the fellowship and because of working with people in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know how they walk in and there's no light on, there's nobody home, you know, and one night they walk in and there's something that looks different with them, and you think, well, maybe it's because they got the haircut, maybe they're wearing a different color, a new color for them. Then you look in their eyes and there's somebody home. And I can't do that, and you can't do that, because it's an inside job. The light goes on the inside. And that renews my hope in God, and that renews my faith in a higher power. And I have a loving God that loves me more than I love myself on most days. And if I just do what I'm supposed to do, suit up and show up, wear a uniform that's got a number on it, not the one that says manager on the back. I leave that hanging in the closet to powers that be. And do what I'm supposed to do, life unfolds in a beautiful way on a daily basis. I had some problems in my marriage when I was 5 years sober, and he started to go to punk rock concerts and flotation tanks and meditation seminars instead of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I tried. We went to a Cramps concert, and I wore a My Doll shirt I made, and I spiked out my hair, and I tried. I went out there, and all they did was knock me around. They call it slamming, and I ended up by the wall like this all night. I had already done all that, and I had to go to Al-Anon, and I had to let him go, and I had to quit burning up his albums in the oven. Talking about a dead Kennedy's album in the morning, and you got it on 400, that just makes my heart sing. But I'd have to call it my Al-Anon sponsor until I was burning up his records again, so I'd take him out. And I walked into my Al-Anon meeting one night, and guess who was sitting there? He was. In there learning how to release me, and we both looked at each other, and we just started to laugh. And we started to work through some things again. He came back to Alcoholics Anonymous, and we started to backpack and do a lot of hiking, and somewhere up in the High Sierras when we got reined in, I got pregnant. And I didn't know I could do that. I didn't know I wanted to do that. And on June 23rd, 1984, my son was born. And I'm a proud mom. I got to name him after my grandfather, Wesley. I never got to make amends to, because I was too high on LSD one night to go tell him goodbye in the hospital. And I love my grandfather, Wesley. He taught me how to fish and catch bugs, and I knew there was God that day, because he was born with all his fingers and all his toes, and I abused myself with a lot of alcohol and a lot of drugs, and I was grateful for you that day, and you were all there. It was funny. It was, you know, there were babies in and out and sponsors in and out, and in the middle of all this, my son was born, and it was just a beautiful day, and my hope to God, he grows up with the legacy broken, because I want to teach him that there is life that is worth living and loving, and give him the program so that he knows that there's some, that he's worth something. I tell him all the time that he's worth everything, that he's God's kid and he's perfect. And I want to break that legacy, and I want to give him some self-esteem and give him a chance. And I can't imagine raising me, you know, it's like, oh God, can't imagine raising myself. But he was a year and a half old, my husband walked out on me. I was happy being a housewife and a mother. I was totally happy for being a housewife and a mother, and I was sponsoring a lot of people, and I was just in seventh heaven. And Al walked out on me, and the rug got pulled on my life, and how can this happen? And I found out later that, you know, there was a newer woman involved, and that it wasn't me, you know. And nobody got custody of our meetings, and It was real painful for a year. It was real painful. I had a sponsor change in there because I picked up my sponsor off an airplane one day, and instead of having almost 21 years, she had 21 days. And I got a new sponsor, and my ex-sponsor is doing fine. She has 6 years. But I asked a guy named Clancy to be my sponsor in the interim because he's the founder of our group, and I had watched him. I had watched him for 10 years. And he's out there in the trenches of Alcoholics Anonymous, giving away and having fun. You know, he's still carrying that torch high. He's at 32 years of sobriety. And he's still learning and living life, and that's what I want. I mean, I drank and used for more. And I don't want to come to Alcoholics Anonymous and graduate. You know, I want to live more of life each day. I want more understanding. I want to know more about you. There's just not enough hours in the day. I'm a greedy alcoholic. It's a selfish program, and I want more. And I saw that in him, that he lives life from the minute he gets up to the minute he goes to bed. He's excited about his life, and I want that too. And he had become my sponsor, and when my marriage fell apart and all of that happened, I was glad he was my sponsor because he walked me through the steps again. I was like a newcomer. I was insane. I was calling him from phone booths everywhere, just bawling my eyes out, just crazy. I had to go get a job again, and I had people walk me through the resume and walk me through the interviews and walk me through this. And my son was a year and a half to 2 years old, and he wasn't quite understanding what was going on, but he got a lot of love from you. When I couldn't give it to him, he got it from you. And I remember one Saturday night meeting that my sponsor happened to be in town. He's out of town a lot. And they were over in the corner, you know, Saturday nights are tough if you're broken up, you know. And he was over in the corner with her, and they seemed to be laughing and having a good time. And God, I hated them. And I had these two hot cups of coffee in my hand, and I had this idea. And, now, don't listen to my head. It's not my friend, but I was listening. And I was on my way over there to baptize them as my sponsor seemed to intercede. He kind of caught where my trajectory was going. And so he kind of came to the middle, and there were tables at this meeting. And he took the coffee out of my hands, and he put it down the table. And he took me by the shoulders and looked me in the eye and said, "Sharon, you will walk through this with dignity and grace so you can be an example for others." Well, I heard him. It's example stuff again, you know. I gave it up that night. I gave up the spare keys to the car. I was going to drive his car in the ocean, you know. So I gave up the spare keys to the car. I told him I had been shoplifting at the Broadway, I mean, so that they'd catch me. I wanted them to catch me, so they put me in jail and have to call Clancy and say I was down there. You know, he'd probably say, "Leave her there," but... You know, I was in such pain. I wanted everybody to know what pain I was in. So I told him I was doing this. I had to go make amends to the Broadway. And I had to quit driving my car 100 miles an hour at night, hoping I'd catch that center divider, you know. And I was real, just real crazy. And he had to focus me in. We had to start with the steps again. And I had to look at me, because when you point the finger, three look back at you. And I had to start working on me and quit judging. And I was sitting in... St. Augustine's Church, waiting for the nun I sponsor on Ash Wednesday. I've made my amends to the Catholic Church, and I sponsor a nun and a lot of other women. I really enjoy sponsoring women. It's just such a rush to watch them. They're so drunk that you have to tie their shoelaces at their first meeting, to watch them run a 27-mile marathon. We can do what I can't do. And I was waiting for Sheila, because she's a loving, wonderful woman that I get to remind to have faith all the time. It's great. And I feel comfortable in the Catholic Church because I've made my amends there. And it was a year and a month after my ex had walked out the door, and I felt the healing happen. It just happened to me. I was sitting there quiet. And it happened from the tip of my head to the tip of my toes. I finally felt whole again. And I was able to really walk on into my own life. And I realized later what a lot of it was just being in the hallway. Nobody had thrown me away. God didn't turn his back on me. I was just in the hallway. You know, I drank Jose Cuervo Gold because it's like starting a Harley. You know, you get instant results.
And in Alcoholics Anonymous, by God, if one door closes, the other one better open. Right now, you know, or at least it better be envisioned. And I was in a hallway for a year and a month, and I have learned how to enjoy the hallways now. Because the other door always opens. Because you get through it all the time, and it gives me faith that the door is there. And if I can't see it, I know I'm going to be able to see it. And I've learned how to just kind of throw some art up on the hallway walls and throw down some throw pillows and sit down with you and ask you about your problem, why you're in the hallway, you know, and my little plans again. Here we go with my little life. And as soon as I can realize there's somebody else having a hard time and we're in the hallway together, you know, and so-and-so got through the door last week, it gives us hope. And I've learned how to enjoy the hallways of life because my faith is here. My faith is right here inside of me. It's strong and it's contingent upon my daily maintenance of working steps 10, 11, and 12. Because if I am not of service to Alcoholics Anonymous, if I am not centered and balanced and in touch with my higher power who loves me, I am out there on the freeway like a mad woman, you know? I learned a lesson one morning when I had just had a spiritual morning. I got up early, I jumped on my trampoline, I'm not Ken Devaney, I don't do it naked with a cowboy hat yet, but he was thinking about me and wrote me a card and wanted to know if I was okay, and I wrote him back. I said, yeah, because I got a trampoline, that's why, it was funny. But I had jumped on my trampoline and done my spiritual readings and made my son his breakfast, and we were off and dropped him off at school, and I'm going to work, and I'm like in and out of that traffic, you know, because this little old lady in a Valiant cut me off, you know, and I just thought, screw her, boy. It all went out the window, and I caught up to her and gave her a snarly look, and then I'm into it, you know, I'm cutting everybody off and making their day, you know, and I finally get to my exit, and I'm just like, you know, I got a headache, and it's 8:30 in the morning, and life is over already, you know, and right there next to me on the off-ramp, it's got two lanes, is that little old lady in her Valiant who's still smiling and listening to this mellow music, you know, and I learned a lesson that day that there's a lot of ways through the forest. There's an awful lot of ways through the forest. Take the way of less resistance is a more joyful, peaceful path. And when I am in touch with a sponsor and I am a strong link in the chain of Alcoholics Anonymous, I can take it and give it away. And I'm centered in my life, then I can have a joyful, peaceful day. And if I don't do those things, I don't. And I also learned another lesson. You can start your day over at 4 in the afternoon. I didn't know that. I thought if you woke up and it was screwed, forget it. It's screwed all day. You can start your day over at 4 in the afternoon. I got this great job at the law firm. I paid this attorney so much money for my divorce. We fought over record albums. We had nothing really to fight over, but I was mad. So paid him all this money. I realized that maybe there was some money in the legal profession. So I went out there and got me a job at this big law firm in Century City, and I worked up from a bookkeeping position to their collection supervisor. And I worked with the managing partner, who's this powerful, exciting man who reminds me of my sponsor, actually. And he says to me, he says, good morning, Sharon, how are you? And you know what? I don't tell him how I really am. I say, fine, thank you, Bruce, how are you? And they pay me money to act like this, you know. It's a joy, you know. And then my last review was that, you know, I'm a valuable member of their team and I am part of their family. And little do they know what they have working there, you know. They have no idea. And it's real good for me to be anonymous at work. It works for me because I have to act better than I feel a lot of the time. And that helps me feel better. Because I can act my way into good living. I can't sit in my bed with my big book all alone the rest of my life and think my way into good living. I have to be out here with you, watching you do it, and having you help push me along. My father, I made some amends to him, and I want to tell you about that because it's very important in changing our relationship. The sponsor, Ginny, I had, who was wonderful for me, told me that I should start making the financial amends that I owed him. And I thought, how does she know? As you know, I'm owing a little bit of money here and there. And she said, well, just call him and be willing. And so I did. Unwillingly, I called him. And I told him I was going to work this step in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'd like to know how much money I owed him. And without really even missing a beat, my father gave me a figure. You know, not even really missing a beat. Now, he had been out to my my meeting and had bought a big book, and I swear he went home with a calculator. And he put it in, you know, in the amends staff, and he said, if Sharon calls, give her this bottom line right here. And I was a little resentful about that, but I called Jenny back, and I said, guess what? He told me this much. I think that's too much. And she said, you're probably getting off light. Call him in a couple of days and tell him how much you can afford. And we talked about that. And we talked about what I could afford. I thought, good, in 2 days, he'll remember. I didn't go to Europe like the rest of the kids. He didn't pay for my wedding like everybody else. He never bought me a car when I graduated from college. I didn't graduate from college, and I took a lot of cars. But so I called him back in 2 days, and he was still on the beam with what I owed him, and he accepted my terms. And so I called her back, and I said, he accepted. And she said, fine, make your envelopes, and without fail, because you are an example of Alcoholics Anonymous, on the first of every month, you send out that check. And she said, by the way, put a note about your life and what you're doing. You know, just some chit-chatty stuff. And I thought, Jesus, here we go, make me grow. I didn't want to do that. What is he interested in my life for? But I did it, and I did it unwillingly for a long time. And I remember getting up there to year three, and I said, Jenny, we've been doing this for a while now. I just think maybe he's overpaid. And she said, no, don't worry about it. He's probably putting it into a trust fund for you, and you'll get it back so you can go buy your Jaguar. And I thought, great, I'll send it early, you know. And so my dad was just getting the end result of me working one of the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, whether I was willing or not. And he called me one holiday season, and this was about 3.5 years into it. And he said, Merry Christmas, Sharon. You don't have to send me any more checks. The debt is free and clear. So don't stop sending me your notes. Somebody took scissors and cut those chips off my shoulders at that moment. And I was able to walk into a free relationship with my father. I am very close friends with my ex-husband today. He got married to that woman and had a new baby. And my son has a stepson, a stepbrother. And now he's moved on from that marriage into something else. And guess who was the example for her of walking through it with dignity and grace? I was. And you never know. You absolutely never know. And we're all friendly, and we'll stand in the backyard at my sponsor's on the 4th of July where you have name tags, and all the Barkers will be there in a row. You know, there's my son and me and my ex-stepwife with the same last name and her kid and the father of all of them, and we're all chit-chatting around getting our pictures taken, and I'll tell you, only in Alcoholics Anonymous, and only with the program, only with the program. And my life is full and free today. I'm just beginning to work on me and parts of me that I'm just beginning to uncover and discover and learn to recover with. And all I know is that, you know, willingness without action is fantasy. Jimmy Ryan taught me that when I was real new. And I have to be willing to grow, and I have to be willing to hurt, and I have to be willing to be happy, and I have to be willing to share it with you. Because I get freedom in that. I thought freedom was just another word for nothing left to lose. You know, I love what Janice said, and you know where she is. And that's the way I live my life. And little did I know, on August 20th, 1975, seconds and inches, because of seconds and inches and a loving God, I came to you, and you gave me myself. Thank you very much, Greeley. I love you.